What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers.
Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, it has become increasingly clear that for Africa to catch up with the rest of the world, the industrialized world, there's a need to increase support and encourage the development and distribution of new technologies and innovations. These are essential catalysts of economic growth, and most importantly, for countries where unemployment rates are staggeringly high, job creation, homegrown technological innovation is also necessary if we want a development that is sustainable. In the past couple of years, the continent has seen a host of young tech entrepreneurs and innovators who are constantly generating and applying knowledge and innovative ideas to local challenges. And that is greatly promising. And there's no doubt that for African countries to make that leap to a middle-income status, young people need to be motivated and supported as they pursue homegrown, technological-based, innovative solutions. Like we have said before right here on the show, technology is that great equalizer that is removing traditional barriers to development. For one, it does not care for geographical location. And that's why we have seen that in Africa, or as elsewhere, it is opening doors of opportunities for young people to find innovative solutions to challenges that have long held them back. And today on the show, we'll speak to some of those innovators that reflect in large measure the spirit of innovation that is driving the continent forward as it tries to meet the 21st century development challenges of education, improving agricultural production, tapping into the vast amounts of our natural resources, and, as we saw in the past year with the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, responding to health challenges with uniquely African innovations and solutions. So stay tuned as we start the conversation right here on Upfront on the Voice of America.
Very many people are finding their way abroad than to work in Africa.
I come from Kenya, but I'm studying in Uganda at Makerere University. I think Africans as a continent and Uganda as a country, we lack innovation because, first of all, we don't have good mentors in our institutions to guide us on what we're supposed to do. And I guess that one comes in terms of now the resources that are dedicated in doing our research and the implementation of the technologies. I guess African labs funding, and most universities just depend on donors, like the Western University, where they are independent and they have substantial funds they spend on their research. So I guess that's why they have strong technology.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, experts say that technological innovation and change in Africa is not just about creating new technologies. Sometimes it's about recreating processes to achieve higher levels of productivity as applicable to their local context. In Kenya, a young social entrepreneur is doing exactly that. Alex Mwaura Mrui developed Farm Capital Africa, a platform that enables investors to put money into sustainable agribusinesses to better connect farmers to investors in what he calls a profit-sharing arrangement. I reached Alex in Nairobi.
Farm Capital Africa we are a company incorporated in Kenya, and we are basically in the business of helping small scale farmers to access expansion capital for their businesses. And we've been doing this for about 2 years now, and have more or less invested about $100,000 or so. So we are still at a very early stage as a business, but, you know, growing by the year. And we are hoping to continue working with even more small-scale farmers, because the need is quite huge in this market for the kind of service that we are offering.
What was your inspiration to start this project?
Well, I have been an entrepreneur for quite a number of years, and I had always known that the access to capital has always been a problem for new businesses and small businesses in this part of the world. But then, as I was exploring solutions towards helping small businesses to access capital, I ended up in a chance conversation with a farmer. And the farmer basically just gave me some sort of enlightenment on the agricultural sector and both the opportunities and the problems that were there. And it just started there. Before I knew it, I had thrown myself full-blown into helping small-scale farmers to access capital.
Does the process work itself?
So what we do is we set up what we call model farms. The idea is to do it in different parts of the country. And then once the model farm is fully set up and is in full production, we source for farmers who are within a certain geographical area of our model farm. And we do capacity building programs with them to help them understand the value of the crop that we choose to cultivate on our farm.
So you actually set up the farms. You do not find existing farms or farmers?
No. We start off by setting up our own farms.
Okay.
And so once the whole point of setting up our own farm is, one, for us to be able to actually have practical experience with that particular crop in that particular area. That way we're able to give more practical advice and support to the local farmers. And then we then use that as a platform to reach out to the local farmers and see those who may be interested in accessing expansion capital.
Do you grow different crops on different farms?
So we've managed to map out the country, and we know what crops do well in which parts of the country. So we choose a particular crop that we know will work there. We do go ahead and plant that crop in our farm. And once we are actually in full production and we can see that the crop is doing very well, is when we actually reach out to the farmers.
Okay. There's local neighborhood farmers who are already, you know,
exactly,
engaging in agriculture, some form of agriculture. Now, do they have to have a specific set of knowledge, or them being farmers is enough to qualify to be involved in your farm?
Definitely important that they're already in farming, which means that they have already at least had some experience with farming, even if they may not have been cultivating the same crop as the one we are interested in funding. But that gives us a good starting point. Normally, the first stage of our funding process is that knowledge transfer process, which means that as long as you're a farmer, even if you had never planted, say, French beans, by the end of that program, you will know everything you need to know about French beans farming.
Okay.
And then from there, now we get into the practical part of it, where we have the initial funding stage where you fund a small percentage of your capital needs just to test out and see how you would be able to, you know, repay that. And if you do well on that first stage, then we have a tiered approach to our funding where you keep getting more and more funding as you are able to prove yourself with the little that you're given.
At some point, do you give ownership of the farms to the farmers?
Well, that's an important question. We don't take ownership of the farms at all. The farmers already own or have leased land, so we are coming to work with them on their piece of land. The model farm is the only farm that we own, either by purchasing land or by leasing land in that area. But the farmers, we fund them to do this on their own farms.
Okay, so they still maintain ownership of their own farms, not the model farm itself. The model farm is basically some sort of a replica of what their farm should be at some point if they have acquired the knowledge and skills.
Exactly.
You don't actually give them capital. You give them knowledge. How does this work?
So we give them knowledge, we give them inputs, and we give them markets. So those are the three key things you want as a farmer. So it starts off with the knowledge stage, where you come in and there's an apprenticeship program where you actually get to work with our people at our model farm to get to really see how it works, and then go and start doing that on your own farm. The second is inputs. So if you need any you know, fertilizers or seeds or pesticides or whatever it is made on your farm, we already have pre-negotiated contracts with different suppliers who ensure that you get what you need at the farm. And then last is the harvest, where we actually, again, negotiate good prices with the market, and we help the farmer access the same markets. So those are the three key things that we provide them as part of our funding program.
And so how do they pay back when it comes for time for them to pay back? How do they pay back? Mm-hmm. But most importantly, how do you quantify how much they should pay back?
Okay, great question. So given that we control the market, it means that once the produce has been sold to a buyer, it is not the farmer who gets paid. It's farm capital that gets paid. And so before the farmer gets their money, farm capital has already deducted what is owed to it by the farmer. Now, how we calculate what the farmer pays to us is as simple as we get the value of all the things that we give them. So from the knowledge to the inputs, to the access to markets. This is based on market rates because none of the things we're giving them is new. These are things that are already in the market. But then we just basically come up with our own margins that we ensure are very, very optimized and still give the farmer the best deal possible than if they were to get all these things individually from many different people. And so when we deduct that, they get the difference between what they owed us plus the margin that we were making of it. And then the difference is what they get back.
That is Alex Maura Murui, the creator of Farm Capital Africa.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to Upfront. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg and Jackson Fungani is in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us. Let's hear some more of your opinions now.
We can develop part by part, but still we don't have that ability to apply it. I'm Kayom Tom from Kampala International University, first year, first semester.
My name is Obulejo Bosco. I'm a Sudanese, but I've lived in Uganda for years. So, to me, Africa has so many resources. Mention them like raw materials, everything. But because they don't have the money, that's when they go into the Western countries to plead for maybe capital and other things to start up, whereby you find that they give them donations and the other funds through strings attached, whereby, you know, instead of coming up with a project whereby they are setting up schools, students who are there can go to school, do the practical work, and at the end of the day or the end of the year, they come up and work for the government for the development of the resources.
Thanks so much for sending in your opinions. You know we love hearing from you. Please also do pop us an email or catch us on Facebook or Twitter to let us know what topics you think we should be talking about. There's a burning issue happening in your neck of the woods. Let us know what it is and we'll explore.
Nadia Sami is in Johannesburg, where our next story of innovation takes place. Now, South Africa has one of the highest rates of HIV-TB co-infection. And while imported technologies have certainly been instrumental in testing and treatment of TB, there was an issue of accuracy by machines used to detect TB. And that's where Dr. Leslie Scott came in. And she developed an out-of-the-box idea that would check the quality of TB test machines. She called it SmartSpot TB. Her innovation is already being used in 13 African countries.
I've been working on this project now before 2010, and it really came about through the need for being able to provide quality diagnostics to settings outside the biosafety laboratory settings where TB diagnosis is currently performed.
Okay. And what are some of those settings outside of the labs where they perform TB testing?
So this could be a clinic in a very remote area, or it could be a smear microscopy center where they would currently diagnose TB off a smear, which is really taking the patient's sputum, putting it on a glass slide and looking at it under a microscope.
Okay.
And so those are...
The technology actually examines the accuracy of machines that are used to detect TB. It doesn't detect TB itself.
No. So if I give you a little bit of history of the diagnosis for TB, well, it has routinely and traditionally been done through a smear under the microscope. But that test is very insensitive. And it's very insensitive if you are also infected with HIV as a patient. And the sensitivity could be something like 35%.
And when you say but sensitive, that means it won't get the right diagnosis?
Yes.
Okay.
So out of, say, 100 patients that are HIV positive and have TB, the microscope smear test will only detect 35 of those.
35 out of 100?
Yes.
That is a big margin of error.
Absolutely. So the alternative test, which still is the gold standard, is what they call culture, where they take the patient's sputum and they put it into enriched media, liquid media, and they grow it in the lab to try and increase the number of bacteria in the sputum. And then they can detect those, and then they can say, yes, the person has TB. But that test can take up to 6 weeks before you get that diagnosis. So in the meantime, the person can die. They go back to the community and they spread the disease. And so in 2010, the World Health Organization launched and endorsed the GeneXpert test. And the GeneXpert test is a machine that you could now put in those smear microscopy centers and all the way to clinics, and it will diagnose a patient with TB within 2 hours.
Now, do you have to know the back-end technology of the GeneXpert test machine to be able to come up with the SmartSpot TB check?
Yes. Well, the most critical thing was to know that the only way the machine will find out if the person's got TB is if the bacteria is in the sputum. Because the first thing that happens in the cartridge of the GeneXpert is it captures all the bacteria on a little filter card.
Has the SmartSpot check decreased the high margin of error for testing?
Yes. So already we know the GeneXpert has a double detection rate over that smear microscopy. But I'll give you an example. In South Africa, we tested about 2 years ago, we reached 3 million tests on that GeneXpert.
Mm.
And if we did not use the SmartSpot to check all the modules on the machines that were put in the field, 78,000 of them could have been in error. So, you know, and the error could be that it didn't give a result to a patient, so it said there was the result couldn't be generated, or it said that the result was negative, in which case the patient would go back to the community and spread the disease.
At what point do you feel that you will start deploying the technology to other parts of the continent or even to the rest of the world?
That already is happening. When we started the SmartSpot product, we used it in South Africa. And we also had several publications that we submitted to the international journals. So as soon as we did that, a lot of countries started contacting us to say, can we also use it? And over and above that, the World Health Organization endorsed SmartSpot to be able to use it on the GeneXpert. So it also, you know, for verifying those machines. So it also came with a big push from WHO to tell other users that this material is available and can use it.
That was Dr. Leslie Scott, developer of SmartSpot TB in South Africa. Dr. Scott is also the first female to win the Innovation Prize for Africa's Social Impact Prize. Now, access to energy is one of the main constraints to development in Africa. Over 60% of the population in sub-Saharan Africa have no access to reliable energy, and this affects all sectors of development. In Tunisia, two young scientists came up with their own innovative solution. It is a zero-blade wind converter, which they say would be both reliable and efficient in generating green energy. One of the co-creators of the technology is Hassine Labate. I reached him in Tunis.
This is a new technology which is radically different from the conventional one in the sense that it is bladeless. There is no blade. There is a completely new paradigm to harness wind and convert it into electricity getting inspired from the sailboat. So the inspiration is the sailboat, and sailboat is till now the most efficient wind converter. So my partner said, okay, how can we get inspired by that to create a new system to harness the wind more efficiently and more eco-friendly?
Basically, it has no blade at all. That's what it is. Sounds a very complicated process.
It's not. Actually, it's a new way of converting linear motion into rotational and reciprocating. So instead of the wind spinning the blades, there is a compact body that is being, you know, oscillating and create this rotation and get the energy.
Now, you started 4 years ago. Have you been able to put it in action yet?
Yes, actually, over the last 4 years, from the concept, we developed 5 lab-scale prototypes, and each prototype is an enhanced version of the previous one. And just recently, a couple of weeks ago, we unveiled the first prototype of the industrial design. So it's a machine. It's no more a lab-scale prototype mounted on a 9-meter-high tower that we did the public demonstration in the presence of VIP guys here in Tunisia and the presence of the regional manager from Microsoft, because we last year we signed a strategic partnership with Microsoft Corporation to help us move from the R&D phase to the scalability and demonstration phase. So the demo was a real success. We showed the real capability of this new technology, of this new machine, in terms of efficiency, in terms of it is bird-friendly, it is silent, and it doesn't disturb airwaves or radars.
Now, how is this going to be used by your regular Tunisian?
The energy problem is a universal one. So it's not the case only in Tunisia. It is in Africa, it is in India, in China. So especially off-grid solution are really required, you know, to power many people that have no access to energy and to the grid. India, for instance, have 450 million people with no access to energy. In Africa, the same way. So even though the project is Tunisian and the inventor and the invention is Tunisian, but we are not limited to Tunisia. It's a universal solution that could be applied, you know, everywhere across the world.
And at what point are you going to start implementing it? When is it going to go into operation? When does it hit the market? When do you forecast it going into the market?
So, you know, developing a radical technology, it's normally a long process. We've been over this for 5 years now. Now the objective, we are in discussion to start the first wind park, most probably in India, whereby the discussion is to build and operate 50 Safonian machines of 20 kilowatt each. So having a pilot park of 1 megawatt in India over the next 2 years. So it's things are advancing very, very well, and hopefully we're going to make sure to make it happen soon.
Hassine Labade, the co-creator of the zero-blade wind converter. It's called the Safonian, which they say would be both reliable and efficient in generating green energy.
Okoko Bioko! MC Galaxy!
Now, as the excitement for mobile phone-based payments grows in Africa, operators are rushing to get a piece of this potentially lucrative and ever-expanding market, and to challenge more popular and established mobile payment services such as Kenya's M-Pesa. And on the line with me is Davis Neziriayo. Davis, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the application that you're working on.
PesaChoice is an application that was born out of the need by the diaspora. Since I came here, of course, I've been sending money whenever I can. And as you know, a lot of diaspora people, we do the same.
Yeah, we send money back home to our loved ones.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, so how were you sending money previously before this?
Using money, Western Union and MoneyGram.
Okay. And how is this going to be different for users who in the diaspora?
Well, this one provides a more convenient way, and it's free. It gives you more alternatives than just sending money, because we went ahead and looked at why do people send money. Most of us send money to help our families. Actually, about 23% of the money sent home goes directly to help people pay bills such as tuition, utility bills, water, and phone bills.
Right.
So our application allows the diaspora, it gives us more control. You can pay those bills directly or send money.
So it is free for users. And how do they access this application?
Our application is available at the App Store. It's available on Google Android phones and iPhone at the moment. So you can find it at the Google Play Store, or you can also go to the iTunes, and it's available there.
What is your current target market?
Currently, we are operating in 3 countries, Rwanda being the first, Rwanda, Uganda, and Nigeria.
Why specifically those 3 countries?
It was the need. When the company launched last year, we started with Uganda. After that, we expanded into Rwanda, we have a large community because we are based here in Los Angeles. We go by the need and how it will be easy for us to market to that community. So we found it was easier for us, and the market also, there's no service. They are also lacking this service in their country. So we offered it there. As we go along, we want to expand into more African countries. Our primary goal is to be able to put this in the hands of everyone, at least for the African continent.
Now, are there other existing applications of this nature?
Well, there is one doing the same in Rwanda.
Okay, so just one currently. You have only one competitor in the market.
There are others that are just doing money strictly money remittance to Kenya and other African countries, but we are the first ones to be operational, at least in the 3 countries.
So in a way, you're changing the money transfer game.
We are hoping to disrupt that the money transfer game by offering this exactly, Pesa Choice, giving free and convenient services available to the diaspora 24 hours.
When we talk about numbers, do you have a figure of how many people in the diaspora would be able to use this if they optimally are able to access it?
Correct. Right now, actually, let me give you the actual volumes that we are working with. Uganda is receiving around 990 million a year from the diaspora. That's a lot of money. It helps a lot to the
in dollars
the economy. Rwanda is receiving $240 million US dollars also
in remittances. Okay.
Nigeria is receiving 21 billion, being the biggest, the second biggest in Africa. Nigeria and Egypt are the biggest in Africa. So a lot of immigrants. We have, you're looking at a population of almost 500,000, at least within the United States, within those 3 countries. And we are hoping we can get this to the hands of at least 10-20% of that population. Give more people, because again, back to our original statement, is the old-fashioned ways of sending money and taking care of our families. We are offering it for free, and our service is available 24 hours.
Thank you very much for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I would like to thank my co-host Nadia Sam in Johannesburg, South Africa. We would also like to thank all our listeners who contributed to the show this time around. And if you have any questions or comments or want to contribute to the show in future, remember to send us an email at upfront@voanews.com. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is @UpfrontAfrica. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. On behalf of my colleague Nadia Sami, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye.